This episode of The Sporkful contains explicit language. From WNYC Studios, this is The Sporkful. It's not for foodies, it's for eaters. I'm Dan Pashman. Each week on our show, we obsess about food to learn more about people. This is the fifth and final episode in our series on food, race, and culture, other people's food. And look, you don't have to listen to them in order. It's not like you're not going to know what's going on. But if you can, I do suggest at least listening to part one before you listen to this one. It'll give you a little more context. As with yesterday's show with actress Rosie Perez, this one was taped live on stage at WNYC's Green Performance Space. Joining me now on stage is the creator of the New York City-based arts collective and radio show Chillin' Island. He's also a former member of the seminal rap group Das Racist. He starred in the short film Dosa Hunt, and he writes about food and culture for the Vice website Munchies. His mom calls him Ashok Kundabolu, but most people call him Dap. Please welcome Dap.
Hi.
So your family's from South India, right?
Yeah.
And, yeah, shout out for South India. Okay. And correct me if I'm wrong, but most of the food that white Americans think of as Indian food is really more North Indian food. Is that fair to say?
Yes. Okay.
But you said that if the food that you more grew up eating, South Indian food, became cool and trendy, you wouldn't like that.
It would freak me out a little bit.
Why?
I mean, like, first things first, got a lot of, you know, Queens Middle School, public elementary school is a lot of like, oh, you smell like curry. That'd be a big insult. Oh, Hindu body odor. You got HBO? No, my parents said, oh, Hindu body odor. And I was like, oh, you don't care if I have HBO at all. And then like kids who look like those kids who asked me if I had HBO in the hallway now want to talk to me at parties. Like, hey, man, I love Indian food. I don't care. Why do I care if you, oh, I have some with me, man. You want it? Let's go to the bathroom and eat this Indian food. And like those same kids, and I'll always remember this. In the third grade, there was this girl named Farida, and the teacher, it was a math class, Mrs. I'm not going to say her name. She's the type who might even be here, though. Anyway, she was talking about how her and her husband had had Indian food the night before. And then out of nowhere, Farida goes, oh, I hate curry. And Farida was South Asian. And I remember being like, I didn't say anything. And I was also like, suddenly when I heard, you know, the teacher talking about Indian food, I was like, oh crap, stop. Let's keep it moving. And I remember being like, Farida, you know as well as I do that you don't hate curry. You love curry. I love curry. Everybody loves curry. But then I knew where she was coming from. She was preemptively like, don't associate me with that. I'm like you guys, you know.
Right.
You know, I want tuna fish in my brown paper bag. You know?
For listeners at home, Dap just made a gross face in response to the idea of tuna fish. Unpack that for me a little bit. Why would you not want the teacher to talk in the class about her eating Indian food?
It would just be another... You know, at that age, you just want to fit in and you don't want to have to explain your culture or what your home life is like when you probably don't even have the words or understanding and context for those things. I'm sorry. What was the actual question? I feel like I didn't answer it.
No, you did. Why would
the
it
South
bother
Indian
you?
Food, right?
Oh, that question. But right. Why would you not want South Indian food to be trendy?
I mean, it's just very, food is very personal. And I feel like if people who look like, you know, do you have HBO? You smell like curry. All of a sudden are talking about how much they love Indian food and opening a restaurant and making the money from the restaurant and doing interviews about Indian food. It would bother me because I was like, hey, you look like HBO in the hallway guy. But I feel like South Indian food has some kind of protections against that kind of thing. It like typically like Telugu food, which is like food from this new state called Telangana that came out of Andhra Pradesh and from the Telugu population in like Tamil Nadu and stuff like that. It's typically regarded as like the spiciest and hottest food in India. And this is like in India, it's regarded as the hottest and spiciest food. So that's not gonna happen here.
Wait, don't you think we Americans could dumb that down pretty fast, Ashoke?
I mean, but let me get to the rest, though.
Okay, okay. Right.
There's a lot of sour and bitter notes to an extent would not fly here, I think. And a lot of the food forms involves like eating rice in a way that I don't think white Americans are used to eating rice. Like you kind of have to eat a lot of particular dishes with your hand because it requires mixing and distributing whatever you're eating with the rice in a way that's just not possible with silverware.
Right, bite before, formation, ratio management.
Yeah, sure. Cashman knows what I'm talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This food sounds like it's up my alley.
Right, it might be,
yeah.
You, but you're one of the good ones.
Okay, thank you. can I get a jacket that says that?
No. But yeah, I think two big barriers to be properly bastardized. But if somebody's going to do it, I just hope that it's like a South Indian dude, sellout guy who's making the money, controlling the messaging of our food.
So you'd rather a South Indian sellout than a white guy comes along and does it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's tough. It's always tough at first. Because, you know, a white guy doing it, it's just you activate that same neural pathway of like, oh, kill, kill, kill. Sellout is like, he looks like me. Brother kill brother? No, bad.
Right.
You're like activating a larger part of the brain and you have to tackle it.
All right, so I want to bring on another guest and continue our conversation now. Is that cool? Can we do that?
Yes.
Thank you.
Please, now.
That was the right answer. Yeah.
Help.
Joining us now is a comedian and actress. You've seen her on Key and Peele, At Midnight, and VH1's Big Morning Buzz, as well as in her own Comedy Central special. Her debut comedy album is called Shut Up. Please welcome Michelle Buteau. So, Michelle, my first question to you was going to be, are people too sensitive? But then I have to say that my producer and I spent 10 minutes this today trying to figure out what the appropriate way to ask you where your parents are from was without being insulting or problematic.
Oh, God.
So maybe I answered my own question about whether people are too sensitive. Can you answer both those questions simultaneously, please?
Well, I feel like it's not what you say, it's how you say it. So when you have a face like mine, you can, you know, you can be from many different places because it's just a mix. It's just like no one keeping their penis in their pants. And no, for real. Thank you. But, you know, when people assume something, that's like the worst, you know, or people are just like, you're Puerto Rican, right? Or if I go to France, they're like, Morocco, Algeria, let me know, you know? And I think the best way to ask somebody where they're from is, where are your parents from? That feels like the less offensive. But my mom is from Jamaica and my dad is from Haiti. And with that said, anybody in the Caribbean knows that like everybody, it's just like a port, everybody's just mixed up. So my mom is half white, her dad was from France. And my dad from Haiti, you know, he's got some Lebanese in him.
So Michelle, what are some of the foods you grew up eating?
Oh, wow, so much. Okay, so my mom would make stew peas and brown stew, a lot of stews, basically. Lots of curry goat. When I was about 10 or 11, I would visit my grandma maybe two or three times a year in Kingston, and I would play with a goat and name it. And, all right, y'all relax. So I would play with this goat, and I'd be like, I want a dog so bad. This is great. And then all of a sudden, the goat would be gone, and we'd have food for 7 days. And then it wasn't until I was like 10 or 11 that my grandma taught me how to kill the goat because she needed help. And, you know, I think it was one of those bonding moments for sure. But, you know, she was like, you live in America. You never have to do this. You just go to the store. But this is how life is here. And she really wanted to share that with me. And I was like, thank you. Like, talk about making a dollar out of 50 cents. That's what they did, you know. She would basically go to the beach and get a wild goat. And then when I was in high school, I dated this Muslim guy who's from Afghanistan. His family owned a lot of restaurants. And in their culture, it was good luck to sacrifice a goat in the restaurant or like your store. It's a sign of prosperity. So it was so funny. At 14 or 15 years old, I was like helping this older Muslim lady just kill this goat. And they're like, where the fuck is this girl from? Yeah. How does she know this? I know the most random things. I'm like, you gotta get the head first, and someone's gotta watch the butthole because he's gonna shit. You gotta get that. You know what I mean? You gotta get
well, the this is really news you can use here on the Sporkful.
You know, what I love about this is I really class your podcast up.
Yeah. Yeah. Coming up, we're going to build upon a conversation we had earlier in the series about what happens when people cook other people's food, and especially what happens when white people cook foods associated with people of color. Ashok and Michelle both have a lot of opinions on this issue. Also, we'll wrap up our whole series by playing a game called Is This Food Racist? Stick around. Welcome back to The Sporkful from WNYC Studios. I'm Dan Pashman. Next week on the show, we'll present our parody of the hit podcast Serial, in which we investigate the true story of a series of office fridge food thefts that took place in a call center in Elkhart, Indiana, 14 years ago. You're not going to want to miss this episode. And speaking of not missing anything, please make sure you subscribe to The Sporkful in iTunes or the podcast app or wherever you get your podcasts. That way, you'll never miss it. Thanks. We've been hearing from a lot of you in response to this series. We talked in episode 2 about the judgments we all make about each other's food and about each other. And we got into the idea that some food is perceived as quote-unquote poor people's food. That struck a chord with Casey, who lives outside Cincinnati.
As somebody that grew up more in the poor, blue-collar, working-class type environment, I can definitely feel the tone and the class resonation in a lot of these topics. Every once in a while I'll go to like an American quote-unquote gastro pub or some place where I see that they have like a $9 macaroni. I have to laugh and roll my eyes at this.
We also heard from a listener named Dan in Queens. He's Chinese American, and a few years ago he was touring parts of Asia. Most of the people on the tour were Chinese, and Dan says even though he speaks Mandarin, when they found out that he's American, they treated him like he was really different. They made comments about him getting a Big Mac at the airport. But when they all came together for the final meal of the tour, something happened.
We ate whole fish steamed in soy sauce and black vinegar, fried prawns, just a lot of more traditional Chinese food, very high quality. And so when the tourist asked me which meal I enjoyed the most on this entire trip, and I instinctively responded, this one, of course. And then that person said, wow, Dan, looks like deep down, you really are Chinese. And I could just remember hearing those words. I felt some sense of warmth and belonging.
Thanks for sharing that story, Dan. And I hope all of you will keep your reactions to our series coming. Record a voice memo on your cell phone and email it to me, dan@sporkful.com. Now let's get back to my conversation with artist Ashok Kundabolu, a.k.a. Dap, and comedian Michelle Buteau, taped live on stage at WNYC's Green Space. There's sort of one question that we address a lot in the first episode of the series that I want to kind of circle back to a little bit here, which is the question of, you know, what happens when people cook other people's food? What are the good things that can come of that? What are the problematic things about that? And as I said at the start, you know, we're not trying to like necessarily answer every single question definitively here, but I would love to try to like parse out a little bit like when's it okay and when's it a problem. And I want to start off by playing two clips of listeners. I'll play the first. We'll play the first and then I'll stop for a sec. But the first clip, these are listeners responding to the first episode of our series. This message comes from Connor in upstate New York. He says he grew up in an Irish-Italian home eating pasta with tomato sauce, boiled potatoes, shepherd's pie, but now he says his tastes are changing.
When I first tried Jamaican food and Pakistani food and Korean food, when I realized that the culinary landscape was vastly more interesting outside of the continent of Europe. And these things have quickly become my new comfort foods because I look to them for what I truly enjoy and things I truly get that you know, that real gastronomic sensation of belonging from. Is that okay as a white guy? Am I allowed to claim these as my comfort foods?
Was that my husband? My husband is such a good cook, considering that his parents cannot cook for shit. And he's like from this like this small town in the south of Holland where they just have like a piece of potato and like a carrot and a piece of meat, and they call that their food. But then, do you know what I mean? They're like, that's our comfort food. It's just right. Like, those are just staples. And, you know, he is such a soulful cook. That is such a great question. Yes, I think he can claim it. My husband could cook Jamaican food better than me.
This next message came to us from Nancy in Toronto. I think it kind of speaks for itself.
I myself am half Chinese, half Lao. There's a little bit of Vietnamese and also Indian in me. I remember when I was a teenager watching Martha Stewart, and she had this white guy come on and talk about pho. And I was shocked because I grew up eating pho, and I was excited, wow, I'm going to see some of my ethnic food that I grew up eating on television for the first time. I was so excited. And so they went on describing the ingredients and things like that. And Martha said to the guy, oh, there's a lot of French ingredients in this pho broth. And she goes, why? And he did not know the answer to that. And I was just so angry. I'm like, dude, you're white. If you're going to talk about this food, at least know the history of it. The reason why there's French influence is because Vietnam, Laos, and Cambodia were colonized by France, calling it French Indochina. That is why the reason why there's French influence in the cuisine. I'm like, dude, just know it. Just know it. If you're going to try and make money, if you're going to try to be famous, you're going to be trying to be popular, trying to educate people about this food, know it, please. That's all.
Right on.
Damn, girl. Yeah. Know it.
So, Dap, can you help me try to identify a line of when's it okay and when's it problematic?
I think it's right there. The first person's like, I like to eat X culture's food that I'm not part of. Nobody's trying to police what anybody can eat in their house or in a restaurant. That's crazy. I'm not particularly precious about my identity in that way. But when somebody's chosen to be the representative of a food who's not aware of the cultural context for these things, that's when it becomes problematic. It's more a question of like who gets to profit, who gets to control like the messaging and people's understanding of this culture. And if it's white Americans or someone who's not from that culture, it just feels like a continuation of the colonization and all these kinds of things. So,
do you think it's possible for a white American to become a representative of a cuisine associated with people of color and to profit from it in a way that is not problematic? Or do you think that it can't, those things can't go together?
Them doing the due diligence on learning about the food and the culture is great. But that they get to come back to America, and because people are familiar and comfortable with the way they look and the way they speak and the way they present their ideas, often these restaurants have ethnic food in deracinated environments that people are comfortable with and spend more money in. That's when it gets to be a problem for me.
I don't think I'm that mad at it. I kind of like to see people's take on stuff. I don't mind.
You know, it's interesting. In the first episode of our series, I talked to Nick Cho, who's a Korean-American listener, who was upset with me putting my own spin on this Korean dish. And one of the things that I came to understand only after I talked with him, like you said, Dap, it's like if people want to mess around in their own home with different ingredients,
go for it.
Go for it. You want to eat, go for it. It's when you're putting yourself forward as an authority or as a spokesperson. What I didn't understand was that I perceive myself as a guy messing around in my kitchen. But like, I have a food podcast, I'm on Cooking Channel. Like, it's not how other people see me. You know, it's not how Nick saw me. He sees me as a person. He saw me as like that guy on Martha Stewart.
Right.
It was helpful for me to hear his perspective. And now I'm like, it's something that I want to be more thoughtful about because I didn't perceive myself that way. But now I understand that other people do.
Right. I kind of see those guys on Cooking Channel and Food Network as a fan of food. Like, I'm not going to go to Guy Fieri's, you know, restaurant and say, I can't wait to try the Mexican. You know what I mean? Like, oh, he just knows so much about those beans. But I'm like, well, what's his interpretation of like an easy Mexican dish or something? You know, I mean, I don't think I, even if you're from the place, I don't even know if you're an expert. Even then, when recipes are handed down from generation to generation, it's still your interpretation of what's happening.
So we agree that, like, if you're putting yourself forward as an authority, you should really know what you're doing. And if you're messing around in your own kitchen, have fun. But there is also somewhere in the middle there, there is this notion that even if you're not going to become an authority, if you're going to be cooking other people's food, even not in a, at an authoritative level, that you should still be trying to understand something about the culture.
Absolutely.
Certainly, I think we should all, it benefits all of us to try to learn more about each other's cultures and to be sensitive to history and to each other's backgrounds, no question. But I do wonder if this feeling like you shouldn't just eat the food, you should also know something, try to know something about the culture, that there's, it's not just a food sensitivity, that there's something more there, that that's coming from something deeper.
I mean, if you're aware of and care about the history of the world and like the power structures that have led to the inequality between countries and within countries and between races and ethnicities, I feel like you should carry that into your taco stand. I think it goes back to like you say I smell like curry, you call me a poo, and now the dominant culture is going to take my culture's food and repackage it and quote unquote elevate it because there's some hole that they have because the food that they ate, it all stinks. Why don't you elevate your mom's crappy casseroles and like your tuna fish sandwiches and do that? Do you have anything? You know what I mean? It offends me. Oh, I'm some white dude and I'm starting this Mexican restaurant and it's my life's work to spread the gospel of Mexican food, and we're gonna pretend that that's just an entry point to learning more about Mexican culture, and that doesn't happen. People go and get hammered at this stupid restaurant. This guy gets rich. He gets to go on cooking shows and put out cookbooks. And then there's women in Sunset Park and Jackson Heights who don't get that opportunity. That's what really happens. But I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
Oh my God. What did you think about, I'm just a nerd, but what did you guys think about Julia Child making a French cookbook then?
I don't care what white people do to each other.
All right.
I think it's time to segue to our big finale. We're going to play a game now called Is This Food Racist?
All right.
You guys ready? Now, I do want to put a disclaimer on this game, which is that we do understand that the word racist is certainly a powerful word. And so, you know, perhaps we're more asking here, you know, you could choose to answer that something may be offensive or insensitive or careless. It doesn't necessarily have to be racist. And really, we want to more get past the yes or no question, and let's talk a little bit about why.
Okay.
All right. Are we ready for item number one in Is This Food Racist? You see before you, and I'll describe it for our listeners at home. Yeah, the people who just went, oh, really like Life cereal. They're like, don't make Life cereal racist. Three boxes of Life cereal. Each variety of Life cereal has people pictured on the box. You see on the left, original Life cereal with the white box has white people on it. The cinnamon and maple brown sugar varieties have people of color on the boxes. Is that racist, Michelle?
Oh, thanks. God, I don't know why these flavors sound like strippers, but okay. As much as I do think it's quite inappropriate that, okay, I see what you mean, it's darker, I'm very happy to see black families in advertising, so I'm okay with this.
Yep.
I don't know their angle. Is their angle... people of color are spicy? Or it might just be a product design thing, because if there are white people on that box all the way to the right, it would not look good.
The contrast might be too great.
But then ultimately, I think that's all smothered by what you said. It's just good to see people of color on that poison cereal that kills people.
Christ.
Item number two. This is a banh mi sandwich, a Vietnamese banh mi sandwich. Not the exact one in question, but you guys may have heard a few months back at Oberlin College, the cafeteria there tried to make a Vietnamese banh mi sandwich, but they use different bread than what is typically used. They use, I think, coleslaw instead of the typical pickled vegetables. And on top of that, on top of it being not the typical style of banh mi, it was also not all that good. Some students said it was racist. Michelle, is that racist?
No, it's just not banh mi, obviously. You know, it's like they, you know, it's their chopped, like you ever seen Chopped on the Food Network? It's like they try to, but the ingredients they had, their mystery basket.
Right.
But they're going to get fucking chopped because it's not banh mi. But going back to what you were saying before, it's like if you have a passion for food and flavor and you have respect for the country, then you're going to make something quite all right. This is someone who's getting paid by the government, who wants the holiday to come real fast.
And what are the chances that an Oberlin student will never have banh mi again in their whole life?
Right.
That's 0%. Impossible. The Oberlin students will, because of this incident, move here and open a little banh mi restaurant.
All right, let's move on to number three. This is a receipt from an Indian restaurant, and you can see that in the instructions that the server wrote to the kitchen, the server wrote on the receipt, very mild, white people. Dap.
It's inappropriate. It's hurtful. They shouldn't have let it happen. They should have kept that receipt for the house, obviously.
Do you remember Thai Tony, like about 15 or 16 years ago, lived in Miami and had a Thai restaurant, and there were a couple of black people at his table, and actually the waitress's table, and what she put on the receipt was something about adding 8%, black people don't tip. And they read the receipt, and shit went down in Miami. Like, Al Sharpton was called in. There was a press conference. Black people don't tip. Thai Tony was shut down. And, you know, I'm just saying, no matter which side of the field you're on, we just have to respect each other.
Ashok Kundabolu, a.k.a. Dap, is the creator of the New York City-based arts collective and radio show Chillin' Island. Their show at the Queens Museum, which sounds outrageous and amazing, debuts April 10th and runs through July. Big hand, ladies and gentlemen, for Dap. And Michelle Buteau's debut comedy album, Shut Up, is available now on iTunes. You can find her tour dates at michellebuteau.com. Make some noise for Michelle.
Yay!
So that does it for our big series, Other People's Food. I know that I learned a lot working on this series, and I hope that you learned a lot listening to it. If you did like this series, I hope that you'll share it online, share it on Facebook, on Twitter, on Instagram. Tell your friends about it. Please help spread the word about The Sporkful. The other thing you can do is to make sure you subscribe to The Sporkful in iTunes or the podcast app or wherever you get your podcasts. That way, you'll never miss an episode. And while you're in iTunes, if you could leave us a good review, that would be beautiful, because then that helps other people to discover our show. So, thank you. This show is a production of WNYC Studios and The Sporkful. It's produced by Ann Sani and me. Big shout out to Ann Sani, who worked her butt off on this series. She did a great job. Special thanks also to Paula Schumann, who helped steer the ship, and to Rebecca Carroll, Richard Ye, Arun Venugopal, Tim Ruggeri, Jolenta Greenberg, and Melissa Egan. Also, special thanks to Jennifer Houlihan-Roussel, Dave Catrone, and WNYC's publicity team, Theodora Kuslin, Mandy Naglich, Sahar Baharlu, Robin Billinghoff, and WNYC's marketing team, and all of our friends at the Green Space and on WNYC's digital team. Jennifer Sendro, Ellen Rolfs, Joanne Klimkowitz, David McLean, Utsuki Otsuka, Nancy Seichow, Ricardo Fernandez, Lee Hill, and Kevin France. Our engineer at the Green Space was Chase Culpin. We got music help from Black Label Music. Until next time, I'm Dan Pashman.
I'm Cecilia Wagnon from the great state of Texas, reminding you to eat more, eat better, and eat more better.